When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Gerrymandering, a custom in American election politics. Gerrymandering. Draw the map so it favors your side, whichever. After a census such as 2020, gerrymandering is much in the news. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, to comment on one particular gerrymandering journey. This is New York State, the all-powerful Empire State, that, according to the 2020 census, is losing one congressional district seat from 27 to 26, that compelled the government in Albany to redraw the map. The news came in February of 2022, favoring the Democrats. 22 of the 26 seats were looking to stay in or belong to a Democratic candidate. However, Judge Patrick McAllister rejected this map as unfair in some fashion and gave it to a map drawer, Jonathan Servais, and the new map is surprisingly controversial. Richard, a very good evening to you. The new map is in place for a primary for the Democrats, not in June, but in August. What is it that the Democratic Party objects to in the new map? Good evening to you.
Well, in the word, losing seats that they hope they were able to get. I think I want to just add one thing to the facts. It turns out this guy McAllister did, in fact, do the maps. But when he first proposed this situation, it was challenged in the intermediate and in the highest court of New York, its Court of Appeals, and both of them backed him. What happened in this particular case is that the problem you have is not with the number of people per district. It's with the shape of the particular districts. And the United States Supreme Court at the federal level has made it very clear that you have to have virtually exact numeral equivalents in particular districts, but they gave the states complete freedom in the way in which they drew the boundary line. And the Democrats took advantage of that. And generally, if you've got 26 seats, you can draw the lines in such a way that you can probably switch three or four of them from a neutral map to your side. What's a neutral map? What they constantly do is they talk about packing and stacking and cracking. What this means, in effect, if you're a Democrat, you give the Republicans three or four districts where they have 70% majority, and then what you do is you take a bunch of districts where you have 53-47. And the theory is you give them wasted votes, and you make sure that every one of your votes counts. The Supreme Court decided that they couldn't do anything about that. New York has a commission, which is surprisingly enlightened, in which it says you're not supposed to use political motivation or racial motivation to do districts. They disregarded all of it. They couldn't come up with a map through the commission process. So then Governor Hochul, what she just did is she had the Democrats draw the map of their dreams, and she signed it into legislation. They thought they would win. It turns out that they lost. And now what they do is they have a map which is completely different from the previous map, because not only did you reduce the number of seats by one, but the guy reconfigured it so as to make the districts more compact. And one of the consequences of this was that you take two New York powerhouses, Jerry Nadler on the one side and Karen Maloney on the other side. One used to be a West side Democrat. The other was an East side Democrat. Now the district goes from east to west through the heart of Manhattan. They're in opposition with one another, and one of them is going to be gone. And this is only within the Democrats. And there's a huge question of where other people are going to go. So it turns out that Sean Mahoney, he's going to stay in Cold Spring. And what happens is his district has been changed. It takes into an area that was previously run by a black Democrat who's now decided to go into the 10th district, where he's going to have to fight a bunch of other people, including the redoubtable Bill de Blasio. So it's a game of musical chairs. Once you start to change one thing, everything else starts to topple, and the map is different. There's nothing you can do to change this map. What people do is they are now trying to figure out who should run where. The judge rightly recognized that you couldn't do this by June, so he added another 2 months to it, but he didn't change the time for the gubernatorial and lieutenant governor races, because those are not apportionment issues at all, which means you're going to have a divided primary, which is going to screw the turnout. So this thing is a royal mess, and everybody calls it chaos. The net effect is clearly to hurt the Democrats, not only by the map, but by the spectacle that has taken place and led to it. They did similar things in Illinois, but the Democrats got away with the redistricting there. So the New York courts, to my view, get some kudos. And maybe what we will do is see a bunch of very close elections. And this could easily determine the control of the House of Representatives.
Let's go to the Supreme Court record, Richard, because what I enjoy is you take me, as if I were your student, to the history of gerrymandering being challenged at the national level. The important case you introduced me to is Colgrove versus Green, argued March of 46, decided June of 46. What is a joy about this decision, and it has to do with compactness, the word compactness, is that the affirmative to a force to oblige compactness included Justice Frankfurter, Justice Reed, Justice Burton, and I believe they were joined by other luminaries of the court, Brandeis, Stone, Roberts, and Cardoza. This is like Murderer's Row Yankees, Richard. We're talking about...
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to make sure Cardoza was dead by 1946. He died in 38. But what Frankfurter did is he wrote an opinion which says we don't get ourselves into the political thicket of trying to figure out how to do this. And what happens is the moment you stay out of the political thicket gets even thicker, and people will start to do terrible things. So he did this, and he said, I can't figure out just how to see to the bottom. 16 years later, I think you were going to mention Baker v. Carr.
Yes.
It was written by Justice William Brennan, who was a student of Justice Frankfurter when they at the Harvard Law School. The two of them actually quarreled a lot, particularly over this case. And what our friend Brennan says, I do have an administrable standard. It's one person, one vote. And that means you have to have districts of equal number. Well, if you, in fact, require equal numbers, people are still going to play politics if they can. And so the politics then emerge with respect to the shape of the districts rather than the number of the districts. And the most famous case is a case called Shore against Reno from 1986, in which the district basically went for 20 miles down Interstate 85 to link up two communities. These are so-called majority-minority districts. The majority in each of these districts has to be a member of some racial minority. And the Supreme Court was prepared to tolerate that. And once it tolerates that, you're going to see very strange things happen. So now, a couple of years ago, in a case called Rucho, Chief Justice Roberts was asked the question, are you going to require that they take the same degree of care on compactness that they did on numbers? And his answer was no. So at that point, all this stuff is free to flourish at the federal level. And then you get the Reform Commission in New York State that is prepared to stop it. So the whole thing basically is wheels within wheels. And this is a case where the state governments, at least in some places, have done better than the federal government. And New York is the primary example. So wonders do happen.
I want to correct the record according to Richard's guidance here. Justice Frankfurter was agreeing with four justices, Brandeis, Stone, Roberts, and Cardozo, who'd written in the Wood v. Broom case of 1932.
Then they were all very much alive and kicking.
Dismissed for want of equity. That was a Mississippi matter. So this matter has been before the courts generation after generation, always twisting and turning. But it seems to come to two terms that are used again and again. One is compactness, and the other is equity, one man, one vote. Those seem to be the guidelines. The one-man run vote, I understand, is not a question in New York. It's the compactness. Where did we?
That's right.
And how did it become so distorted, given the recommendation of the courts? I'm lost how you could reverse or ignore Colgrove. It seems written in stone that you must be compact.
No, Colgrove rejected the claim. It said, oh, there's a political thicket. What happened is, then Baker v. Carr says one man, one vote really matters, and they construe it very tightly. But the compactness thing becomes much more important because it's the only way you could play politics, so the districts become more grotesque. And at the federal level, eventually Chief Justice Roberts wrote for a majority of the court, we're not getting into this political thicket. So there's no political thicket with respect to numbers, but there is a political thicket with respect to shape. The New York Commission decided to do otherwise. Now, there is a very complicated question about how much of this has to be done by the legislature, and the common assumption is all of it. I do, if you actually go back and read the constitutional text, what happens is it says the federal government or the states control the time, place, and manner of an election, a very common phrase, except with choosing of senators, because they were chosen in a very different way back in 1787. It's kind of obsolete now. And I don't think that redistricting or eligibility for votes are matters of time, place, or manner. So I don't think there's any federal override over those issues. So if they're left exclusively to the state, they could organize their business whatever way they want, and the state legislature doesn't have to do it. They could appoint a commission. That issue was debated in an Arizona case in which the Supreme Court said, we think the legislature includes a commission, and that's verbal double talk. I think the correct answer is the federal constitution did not tell the states how to run the districting process that they had to do for apportionment. And so they're free to use the commission. The commissions, by and large, are imperfect, as is everything, but demonstrably better than the political situation. And this guy Servants, he seemed to have done a very good job. He got a lot of testimony. He listened to this stuff. Nobody's ever going to get compactness as the sole criterion. The third criterion that people really care about is affinity groups. So suppose what you do is you have two communities. One is Korean at 55%, and the other is Irish at 45%. If you ask members of both groups what they would like to have a Korean district of 55 and an Italian district or an Irish district of 45. What the one man, one vote requirement says is they have to be equal. So now there are going to be a number of people who are Korean who are going to be feeling stranded because they're going to be in a district of a different ethnicity. So people actually really care about that. But the Supreme Court says it's completely irrelevant. And so what you do is you see this very strange difference between the commands that come from on high and the preferences that come from below. And a guy like Servants, he's running a commission. He knows what the mandate is, but he keeps his ear to the ground. And to the extent that there's some kind of wiggle room, he will accommodate the wiggle room. I think in general, it's very important to be able to do that because you want people to feel comfortable with their choice of the person who's going to elect them. Now, there are going to be many cases that are much more complicated because you're not going to have just two particular groups. You may have four or five groups within close proximity of one another. You can't do anything about that. You shouldn't even try. But at least in some clear cases, you can do it. And the commission guy probably is going to be in a better place to do that if he or she is conscientious than the legislature, which is this very awkward, very contentious, highly dubious sort of group. That seems to be the way it played out here. The commission in this case was just the last resort. Everything failed politically. And so what they decided, since it failed politically, we had to do this. Otherwise, we're stuck with a map which is illegal. And they'd rather have a dubious commission than a thoroughly discredited map. So it's the world of second best. They will play this out. I hope it becomes a precedent for doing things in other districts. And I hope that the position that I have taken, that commissions are perfectly legitimate, the federal government does not have an oversight on this, will eventually prevail. Who knows, however, because the Supreme Court, I think, has misread the key constitutional provision about time, place, and manner. So there is where this thing sits, and we will see how the election starts to come out. It's going to be a very interesting fall.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.